Welcome to this Kill Your Darlings podcast. I'm Estelle Chang, the online editor. It's 1930. Winsome McClintock is a convent girl about to marry a man she barely knows, and she will follow him to Rangoon, then the capital of Burma. Rangoon is a rich and exciting city, but it's also full of tension. The wealthy British residents live luxurious colonial lifestyles while riots break out in the streets. And it's amongst all this that Winsome is discovering the nature of desire and the complexity of identity. Joining us today to talk about her debut novel, The Monsoon Bride, is Michelle Ang Thin. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about Winsome, maybe to begin with. I mean, when we first meet her, she's on a train and she's on her way to a totally new city and a completely new life.
Yes. Well, first of all, she's young. That's an important thing to know, because I think that when you're at that particular time in your life, she's around 18, 19, that's when your greatest potential for disaster is, I think. And well, certainly my experience in life is that my greatest potential for disaster was when I was around that age. She's young. She's been raised in a convent. It was a typical thing for mixed race girls to be taken away from their Burmese villages and then educated in the Western culture and religion. So she has a very limited experience of the world, but it's a religious convent, and so she has certain outlets. One of the minor characters is a key mentor for her. She's very curious about the world, and she's very excited about coming to Rangoon, because it means that she's going to get to experience life at its most exciting in Burma. So she's just ready to go.
Yeah. Mm. And so to begin with, she does love her new life. As you say, she's discovering all these new things, and of course she's newly married. But then things begin to change, and they're not kind of as wonderful as she thought that they would be. Mm. And to begin with, Winsome and her husband, the man that she marries, Desmond Good, they're very different people, aren't they?
They are different. They're both have a similar ethnic background. So they're both of what's called mixed race. So Anglo-Burmese and Anglo-Indian are the typical kind of mixtures or identifications that you would identify them as. And they're different in that Desmond is older, and he marries because he's an incredibly ambitious person. He's obsessed with the colonial concept of prestige, and he needs a wife, in other words. And men did generally wait until they were in their late 20s, early 30s, often mid-30s, this is across the board, so the colonists as well as people in Desmond's position, to find themselves a bride. And it was also a common practice for Anglo-Indian and Anglo-Burmese men to go to the convent or to go to a mission school and find their brides there. But their outlooks their world outlooks are really quite different. Desmond's really about reading the hierarchy around him, whereas Winsome is much more of in a way a free spirit, but she sees the world in a less blinkered way. And she's really, because she's so incredibly hungry for experience, she's inclined to takes more risks, greater risks than Desmond is.
Yeah. And of course, one of the things that Winsome, having grown up in a convent, is discovering in this married life is sexuality and desire. And this is a book that I think is very attentive to physicality, whether it's the wet heat of Rangoon or how desire feels to the characters. And I wanted to ask why that was important for you to kind of get across in this book.
Well, the thing that I think what I do with this book is I wanted to write back to that colonial tradition. So, you know, the E.M. Forsters, the Marguerite Duras, the Somerset Maugham's. But my perspective on it is, of course, very different, because I come from this in-between mixed-race perspective. So not a colonist, not a colonizer, but somebody very much in between who's slightly observant. And one of the things that is absolutely key to this identity is the ambiguity, the racial ambiguity of skin. You know, we're very used to associating ethnicity, race with skin. It's a biological concept in the way we think of it. And yet, for people of mixed race, skin is completely ambiguous, and it's variable in its appearance. So skin was like one of those really deep-seated metaphors for me when I started the novel. And so there's an incredible physicality. There's it's about how you are in a world that's centrally perhaps overwhelming. So very centrally oriented, Winsome is, and so is Jonathan. And I was also very interested in what happens when skins actually touch. So skin's a big metaphor for the way you touch a culture, the way you touch other people, what happens in that moment of contact, what things are thrown up that are unexpected, and how you negotiate your way with your culture and your identity, which is not necessarily an easy thing to do when you're in touch. So touch and skin are pretty key.
Yeah. And you mentioned Jonathan, Dr. Jonathan Grace, who is Desmond's boss. And Jonathan and Winsome, have an attraction to each other, and that goes on to develop more throughout the book. But Jonathan, again, has a different view on it again, because he's white.
Yeah.
And he thinks he's more open-minded about non-Anglo people than the other white people that he does socialise with and work with. What's his take on Rangoon and the city and all that?
Well, actually, Johnson is a good example of what intellectually you expect to find in a particular place, and the difference between that and actually getting somewhere and physically experiencing it. So when things touch Jonathan, he is surprised by his reaction. I think with Jonathan, his take on things is that he sees himself as a decent human being. He sees himself as somebody who wants to do good in the world, who is morally pure. And yet, he's also a human being, so he has his sexual urges. And like many white men of the time, he's extremely well resourced. So if he makes a mistake, he can back away from it more easily, and the repercussions aren't as serious for him. So that's one important thing to remember about him. And, many of us are well-resourced, so it was really important for me as a writer not to judge him for backing away, as he kind of sometimes can do. And the other thing that was important to think about with him as I was developing the character is how he was constantly in negotiation with his idea of what was ethical and what was permissible. So, I think there's an old saying in the Colonial Club, which was, when it gets sultry, it's time for adultery. And the book kind of does kind of play with that old idea of what's allowed a white colonial male as opposed to a non-white colonist or colonial like Desmond.
So, I mean, Jonathan, he is struggling with all of these different ideals that are thrown up by being in Rangoon as opposed to, back in England. And he finds it very uncomfortable too. I mean, on the one hand, there's this incredible loneliness that a lot of the British expats explain, that, you're on your own and you feel this incredible loneliness. But there's also, on the other hand, this phrase that you use, it's a life continually among others. And why do you think he struggles with this so much?
Well, I think the thing about race and identity is that so many things intersect there. So class also intersects, your upbringing, your sort of sense of self. And I think with Jonathan, he isn't like a lot of the in the colonies. There was this kind of weird hierarchy among the Europeans. So the very highest top of the tree people were the civilians, so-called. So people who worked in the civil service, and people who were medics or in other allied professions were looked at with a little bit of suspicion. So Jonathan isn't top drawer, put it that way. And so he is in negotiation with that. So he's, socializing with people who aren't necessarily his peers. But he's also part of this new breed. I think George Orwell wrote Burmese Days around 1929, and there was a real sort of change in the attitude of among young Europeans, actually post-World War I, in their understanding of how colonization worked and the whole white man's burden. That was really beginning to be kind of questioned more in that generation. And so that's partly what informs Jonathan's character.
Rangoon is a place that's filled with people from all over the world. It's a port city, and there's people, constantly coming in. And also, consequently, as we've already talked about a little bit, there are many mixed-race people in the city, which creates quite a lot of volatility, obviously. What interested you about this social landscape and the mood of Rangoon in the 1930s specifically?
Well, I was born in Rangoon myself, and I have always been interested in unpicking what that mixed race identity would feel like in situ, as it were, so in the place where it makes the most sense. That was one of the reasons I sort of began the novel, and I sort of thought about contemporary setting, and then I just sort of went back to looking at Rangoon as a possible time and 1930 as a time. And when I started to research it more, I discovered some amazing things about that city. It was in 1909, I think, or at the turn of the century, it was the second largest migrant port. And then my idea of what mixed was and what diversity was kind of changed as well, because mixed race in the context of Rangoon isn't only European and Burmese or European and Indian. It's not just that Western Asian mix. There's also mixed Burmese, Chinese, and Indian. So it's the complexity of it was like a gift, you know. It just was something that you absolutely had to kind of look into more. It was just such a heady mix. So I started, it started as a kind of personal thing, and then the more I looked into that particular setting and the possibilities that it held for me as a writer, the more kind of seductive it was, you know. You just couldn't go past it.
Yeah, I do want to ask you about the research that you did.
Okay.
A little bit later, but given that there are these incredible mixtures of characters and people in the town, given their cultures and their backgrounds, I really think one of the most interesting characters in the book is a woman, and please correct my pronunciation if it's incorrect, is Dorsane.
Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about her character?
Well, that's an interesting thing that I discovered through my research in part. There was, after the Second World War, there was a kind of, I mean, the First World War, sorry, there was this change, as I mentioned. But over the time from the annexation of Burma, so late 1800s, there grew up, things changed in the way that Burma was run. And the royal family had formerly been in charge, but that kind of, the royal influence gave way to a more of a middle class and a professional class who were mimicking English ways of being. So Dawsane's a classic. She went to university, and she went to universities in Europe. She's I gave her a degree in chemistry.
Yes,
or in possibly. Science. Yes, at London.
She works as a photographer. She's got her own business.
And yeah, she has a family business. So one of the things that, so she follows, like very many people in the generation, in her parents' generation, she follows the very Western or English way of doing things in terms of education, how you see yourself, the kind of job, your ambitions. And then what was also interesting is that the initial student groups, independence groups, or just independence from Burma groups, were interested in, one of their mottos was to be financially successful, to be commercially successful was a way to actually, it was important to be commercially successful to enable independence of Burma. So that was the way that they saw. So a lot of the early student movements were also connected with law students, with people who saw that a commercial advantage was also a political advantage. Perhaps that's the best way of putting it.
Mm. And it's interesting the way that people respond to her as well, because Winsome applies for a job working with Dawsane and neglects to tell Desmond that she will be working with a woman who is Burman, as they were called, as Burmese were called in the 1930s. And when he does find out, he's, you know, he's obviously really angry. But, you know, some of the white women that he does talk to then say, well, you know, it's kind of, that's okay, I suppose, she's educated, you know.
Yeah.
It is very interesting how they all react to her, because she's that interesting mix.
Yeah. I find her, the two characters were really intense in the novel, and Dawsane's one of them, and so is Desmond. And the thing I find found most empathetic about Dawsane is her relationship to her culture, because she's been educated through in Europe, and because she's done this European tour, because things European have been kind of privileged to her in the previous generation, and yet she sort of has this hankering for her own land. She has this really complicated relationship with her idea of what Burma is, and with what she feels that she's missing, and with what she kind of feels she needs from her identity but isn't getting. And that, I think, is a big motivator. And it's also something that is makes her unpredictable. I think with anybody, it's a difficult thing to negotiate, and you never really have a set way of thinking about yourself when you're constantly in questioning your own culture and what it should be, and who you should be, and how you should speak, what you should speak, what language.
And speaking of someone who you know, is very interested in her own country and her own culture, as you mentioned, you were born in Rangoon too.
Yes.
And so the location that you've chosen for the Monsoon Bride has a particular significance for you.
Yeah.
Have you returned to Burma since then?
No, I haven't actually. I was in Thailand in 1997 or something, and I waved across Burma. It was like 10 kilometers or just across a stretch of water, but I've never actually been back. I have lots of relatives who've been back, but I haven't. And it was partly because for such a long time, well, you know, it was always a difficult ethical thing, you know, whether or not you should travel in Burma. But it was as much my own personal fear of what might happen to me there, and also the kind of emotional impact that it might have to go back and see this place that I'd heard so much about and where I was born and, you know, look at the house. It would have been kind of a weird, oddly sentimental but hollow experience, I think. So no, I haven't been back, and but I think I might probably be in a position to go now. We'll see what the next few years holds.
Yeah. And one of the things I wanted to ask about this was how writing the novel actually affected or fit in with how you conceive of your relationship with Burma, or how you think about Burma in your own life. I mean,
well, it was always, I grew up in Canada, and I was the only Burmese person except for five others who were my family in a thousand-mile radius, or at first. And then, you know, the only people we knew were the ambassador to Canada from Burma. That was it. And then, you know, there were a few other immigrants. But generally, it was somewhere that you had to explain. And then when you did explain, you also had to explain about the whole fact that you didn't speak Burmese and, you know, you had this kind of complicated identity. And then you would also have to explain the terrible totalitarian regime in Burma, the whole Slork thing. And so it was always one of those places that it was a conversation killer, to say I was from Burma. You know, it was incredibly complex. And in a migrant culture in the West, people just kind of expect you to say, well, I'm from here. And so you can be Asian, Canadian, you can have this kind of slash. And so it's actually not terribly complicated. But my relationship with Burma was always emotionally complicated because it was such a strange place, and because such negative things were associated with it politically. Writing this book, first of all, as I said before, I really was very interested in trying to just piece together that mixed race experience because of the non-speaking of Burmese, my inability to speak Burmese. And my parents, both of my parents, it's a second language for them. And now I think the best thing I think that comes out of it, of any novel, is that you are obliged, you know, I think it's Barbara Kingsolver who says, you know, put your finger in the uncomfortable places. So this is clearly began as a relatively uncomfortable place for me, but pulling out all the different strands that make it uncomfortable, all the different things that make you think a particular thing about a place was it's the stuff of novels, isn't it? So it was an intellectually, emotionally, and I don't know what the other one would be, philosophically maybe, interesting thing to do.
And you've mentioned elsewhere that the stories your parents told you about Burma were one of the kind of starting points for this novel. And I'm interested in what kinds of stories that they told you.
Well, Estelle, my goodness, it was everything. It was from gossip. So like, oh, so-and-so.
All the best kind of stories.
I know, they are. And the gossip was sometimes kind of macabre. You know, there was this story, I actually turned it into a short story about this family who were just about to, after Burma got its independence in 48, a lot of people of mixed race or settler white, so people who'd been there for generations but were still kind of technically white, were given free passage to England. And there's this one family, another Catholic family, and they had on their mantelpiece, they had this, their passage tickets, all of them, five, six or seven of them in the family. And the mother died the day or 2 days before they were meant to leave, of a backyard abortion. And so they had her funeral with those tickets on the mantelpiece. That's the kind of gossip. That was the macabre gossip. And then, you know, there was the, oh, we went to the part, you know, we went to this dance and I wore this and my tailor made it out of taffeta. And so it's from that to that. And, you know, when they say, I hope you don't live in interesting times. Well, I think they lived in interesting times. My mother especially tells you stories about the Second World War, about being on the last plane out of Michener. I remember when I was researching this in the British Library, there was this book of refugees coming into India, and I found their name in there, you know, and I knew that they'd been in this terrible train crash, and as a result of that, they'd bumped all these people on the last plane out of Michener, and everybody else who didn't get out by plane had to do this terrible overland trek through the mountains, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people died. So it was that kind of thing. All kinds of stories, from the absolute ridiculous privilege of a colonial lifestyle right down to we almost died, we had this terrible crash, we faced death again and again and again, and I was 5 years old, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing stories.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah.
And yes, just to come back to the research that you just mentioned, in the acknowledgements you do mention that you spent a lot of time doing research for the book in London and in Adelaide and in Melbourne. So what did you set out to discover?
Well, first of all, I did want to set it in Rangoon, and I did want to set it in the 1930s, and then I realised that I didn't actually know that much about Rangoon in 1930, and really, to do it justice, you need to have a good idea of the texture of a place. It's really important, I think. And so I started with the Melbourne Library, and I found this book about the history of sewage in Rangoon, which sounds really dull, but actually was hugely useful, because I discovered amazing metaphorical things like the central city of Rangoon was at sea level, or it was always flooded. So the British Army, when they first established the city, literally brought all the soil and raised the center up by a meter by hand. And the shortage of water was really important. Who got it first? The way the city stank in some places because of the open drains and didn't in others, where mosquitoes were more likely to be found, where you might be attacked by a tiger in 1927 on the outskirts of town, that kind of thing. So that was where I began. And then I was really interested in, of course, the ethnic mix, like the social demographic makeup. And so that I found a lot through old journals, old geographic journals, and geographers. There was this pair called, I think they were called True Blood and Spate. They had this kind of really great,
wow.
Yeah, I know, you know, sort of, oh my God, those people must be explorers and, yeah. You know, spent some time in Rangoon as geographers. And they had these amazing maps of the city where they would actually map out which areas were Indian, which areas were Chinese, which areas were Burman, and which were kind of English, and then which were kind of mixed up with the different ones. I was interested in how the authorities looked on people of mixed race, and so a lot of my research in the British Library was around that. And it was a bit tricky because Burma was ruled as a province of India, so you had to kind of winnow your way through the research to find something that was ostensibly Indian but actually about Burma. So the texture, I spent a lot of time at the Wellcome Institute as well, because they have an excellent medical library, and I was in one of the settings in the book is a hospital and mortuary, and I really needed to know how basic stuff about how hospitals were set up, what sort of medicine was practiced, and that was absolutely fascinating as well.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, it's all gone into a wonderful book, The Monsoon Bride, and thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Pleasure.
And thank you for listening to this podcast. For more information, visit www.killyourdarlingsjournal.com.